This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even the speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Why We Argue podcast, the Future of Truth edition. These episodes are made possible by the Future of Truth, a project at the University of Connecticut Humanities Institute, generously funded by the University of Connecticut and the Henry Luce Foundation. The episode you're about to listen to is part of a series on Seeing Truth, a museum exhibit and subset of the Future of Truth project that seeks to challenge audiences to see art, science, and truth anew in this political moment. In these episodes, Seeing Truth project leader and art history professor Alexis L. Boylan interviews artists and academics about the relationship between art and science, the role of museums in the production of knowledge, and how we use the visual to make meaning.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Alexis Boylan. I am a professor of art history and Africana studies at UConn and the director of academic affairs at the University of Connecticut's Humanities Institute, the curator of Seeing Truth, and the very happy interviewee of our programming series of interviews with brilliant artists and scientists and researchers and museum experts. And today is a real treat for me. And I think it's going to be a real treat for everybody. Our guest has so much knowledge, it frightens me. I will just say that. Just knows something about everything, and not just something like mundane, something amazing about everything. And I did also want to just note that all of this programming and the exhibition have been generously funded by the Luce Foundation, to whom we are very much appreciative for supporting this conversation about art and science and how we make knowledge, specifically in museum spaces. So Joel, I hate, as I say every single episode, I hate introducing people because I feel like I'm always too stiff and I will mispronounce something and I will overemphasize the wrong thing. And then always people feel weird and old when you introduce them because you're like, oh man, that's like a lot of stuff. So actually it gets at none of what a person is or who they think they are. So I have allowed each person to introduce themselves. So Joel, who are you?
My name is Joel Swimler, and that's how you pronounce my last name. It's a toughie. I recently retired from the museum. The museum asked a lot of people to do early retirement during COVID, which, as everyone knows, a lot of people did that. But I was fortunate that I was in the middle of two major projects, so they asked me to extend. So I worked an additional 2 years, and I just really retired. And then I had this wonderful opportunity to work on this grant with you and Tom to research objects from our collection. And hopefully I can have time to research other objects in other collections as well, because I was looking at some of them and going, oh, I could contribute to that. So, but I think I should just start how I came to the museum. In right out of graduate school, which was in museum studies and American art, I was offered a job at Alana State Historic Site, which is Frederick Church's house in Hudson, New York. And that's just an amazing house. It's a Persian castle completely filled with his original items. The family had always preserved it. And there's a few things missing, but everything was pretty much there. And now that I look in the back, I think, oh, that's just like the pinnacle of cultural appropriation, because this is a man who just loved the exotic and just filled this house with the exotic. living in Hudson was pretty isolated, and I found myself going to New York City, which was about 2.5 hours away, every weekend. So I decided that I needed to find a job in New York City, and I applied to many institutions, was offered a couple of jobs. But I was offered a job at the American Museum of Natural History, which is not my background, is in science, it's in American art. But they had an NEA grant in 1990 to identify and catalog their fine art collection. And that is probably the most amazing job anybody could be offered, because essentially I came into the museum working out of the library, and I went looking through all the closets and storage areas of the museum. And this, as people know, this museum is vast. And there's just so many things. And at the end of that project, I had identified over 2,000 objects, art objects, and not the indigenous art, obviously. It's the what they considered fine art, which I don't know if that's an appropriate term. That's what it was identified in 1990, was the fine art collection. And it's just, you know, this museum is old. It dates from the 1870s. And it just had collected so many things over the years. And I would open a closet and there'd be a Catlin painting, or I'd open another closet and there'd be 20 Audubons, you know, sitting in a row. And so I was able to identify them. I did basic cataloging, and then I created a database. I was not able to do the print collection because that's even bigger and vast. So I mostly focused on paintings, watercolors, sculpture, murals, and kind of mixed media pieces. And then after that, the library liked me, so they offered me the job to be collections manager and special collections manager. And so I was able to come in and work with the special collections here, which are vast and numerous, millions of photographs, artwork, the whole bit. And one of the things I was doing a lot was working with the exhibition department on exhibits. And at that time, we were doing the 125th celebration of the museum, and we did an exhibit, and I worked very closely with the exhibition department, and I realized I really enjoyed doing exhibits. So I moved over there. And for the next, say, 25 years, I worked on the temporary exhibition program at the museum. And that also was an amazing opportunity, because instead of focusing, you know, I love the scientists here, but I don't think I could study fruit flies all my life or, you know, some thing. But with the exhibition department, essentially every couple of months, you're starting a new project. And then, you know, I was so lucky because I was able to do the diamonds exhibit and work on Einstein exhibition and the brain. And this opportunity also flew me all over the world to look at collections and to work with other institutions and bringing their objects to the museum. So that was an amazing opportunity. And I just think back, and people can't really say that they held a 15,000-year-old basket from Israel, or that they were able to put Elizabeth Taylor's engagement ring on their finger. I was wearing a glove, but on their finger, and it was, you know, it was over 20 carats owned by.
What I love, Joel, is that what I love about you, and that I feel real kinship with, is that those are equally important things and equally exciting moments.
Oh, I held the third largest diamond in my hand.
Yeah, no.
I actually went downtown with a guard to collect it. So I've just had, I would say, amazing adventures, you know. Touching Einstein's theory of relativity document. Yes, it was, you know, encased. Or one of my first projects was Leonardo da Vinci's Codex Leicester. I mean, you can't you can't beat that in the world of art and science and just history. It's just amazing. So I think I've had some wonderful opportunities here and done amazing, wonderful things. And I've always had a love of the library and its collections. And any project that I worked on, I always came here first, because you never know, because the museum and its libraries have just collected everything through the years. So
So I just want to actually let everybody know, I mean, Joel, you really sort of, in your very modest way, sort of like, oh, right. And I did this cataloging of all of the art objects in the museum. But as someone who came after you in terms of needing that research, it's phenomenal. I mean, and the museum before that, I mean, the museum has a very complicated relationship to the idea of art and the idea right. of objects. And you suggested this with, of course, there's a lot of problems around the questions of indigeneity and what perhaps white settler colonialist scientists might imagine as art or might imagine as a specimen might have very different kinds of designations to the people who made it. The flip side of that, of course, is that a lot of very famous and not famous artists made works of art for the Natural History Museum that then were not considered scientific enough, were not interesting enough, and just sort of were put away in cabinets. I think one of the things that our listeners might also want to hear or just need to know is that each, at the AMNH, each office is kind of like a fiefdom, like, you know, that the anthropologists are their own department and paleontologists are their own department. So you really did have to go to the whole museum. And I can only imagine digging through all kinds of spaces, looking up at ceilings, also
attic spaces,
murals that have been covered up and all that right. sort of thing. So, I mean, I do want to just sort of note, you were very modest about it, but you've done an incredible service to, I think, those of us who study U.S. visual culture and sort of documenting this.
A good story. Let me just interrupt you.
Yeah.
About the issues I encountered. I went to the entomology department met with the you know, the foremost scientist on spiders, Norm Platnick. And he's like, oh, what are you looking for? And, you know, he actually had some framed pieces of art in his office. And I said, oh, things like that. And many of those things were old scientific drawings and collections. But he said, oh, you know, maybe you'd be interested in this, but it's not art. It's scientific illustration. Mm-hmm. And so he opens a drawer and pops a shoebox, but something old and decrepit. And inside was a collection of watercolors of American spiders by a man named Nicholas Hentz from the 1820s, one of the first scientific illustrators in America.
Right.
I mean, he predates all the famous bird illustrators. And I'm like, oh yes, be very interested in that. And even though I found what was in that drawer and started that conversation that he had them, people after me, like Tom and May here in the library, you know, went there maybe 12 years ago. I think he had retired and his scientific assistant said, oh, would you be interested in that? And they actually found more of them. And it turned out to be an unpublished manuscript of American spiders that was never published.
Wow.
And they've said, oh, we'll take those. And they were able to bring them back to the library. They were all encapsulated and they were able to do the research. And some of those spiders were the first descriptions of spiders, but because they had never been published, someone else was able to name them, but he had described them. So I know one of the questions you have is what's the importance of archives?
Right.
And I think especially in science, it's important to have a history of how things were named.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if someone discovers some strange bird in the middle of nowhere, they would come to the library to see if someone else had seen it and described it and possibly published and named it. That's just part of the process here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, pre-photography, when people were describing, they had to draw it, especially if they were going to publish it. And that's why we're particularly rich in scientific illustrations.
Right. Photography imagines, or people imagine, that photography resolves issues. But as we have discovered and I've talked about,
photography can be faked.
It can be faked. But also, I mean, I think that, you know, when collecting scientific samples, colors fade, animals, you know, that you can film animals, but that there is also still something about illustrators doing their work that is just also fascinating, because the photograph becomes such a way of sort of imagining truth that we forget about the ways in which truth was identified and realized, and how much knowledge is built on that truth, which is actually has drawings of spiders as sort of crucial parts of it. So those drawings might not be the things that we look at particularly now, but it's not that we haven't built on that. And so if we're going to talk about a foundation of knowledge, we can't ignore it. I mean, I'm interested though, because I do think that there is this tension. And I'll just actually say that this is my perception as a scholar that's worked in the museum and with the museum. And I'm on Team Archives, right? Like, I mean, I can't pretend like I'm on any other team. Like, I'm Team Archives. I want the archives to take over the whole museum. Like, that's, you know, I'm an art historian. That's what I care about. But I do sense, and I sense this in the historical documents, that there has been some antagonism between, for example, the exhibitions department. It is very interesting and not always the case that exhibitions won't come from within their own departments, but will be coming from exhibitions departments who will then go to home departments for information, but sort of manage.
That's not always the case at every museum. Many museums are smaller and the exhibits come out of, quote, the science department.
Right. And so then again, I think that, you know, the archives, you know, there's always been a kind of paper trail of, you know, writings and copies of letters and that sort of thing.
Which but is, movement, you're legally responsible to have that.
Right.
As a 501c or whatever it's called, right, incorporation, right. We have to be able to show somebody that what we've done.
But the movement of what we call, what was originally called, and that's why I'm using these air quotes, at the museum memorabilia is actually a relatively, I mean, you know, not relatively, but, you know, that's a process that gets started mid 20th century. But I do sense that there is, I mean, and of course, right, there are limited resources at any institution, that there is some tension between why bother keeping all of these old dioramas or all of these illustrations.
Spending money to preserve them.
Right. And also then, I mean, I think that the other added question is like a lot of pieces, and we were talking about this and mentioned it earlier, and I'm not in any way referencing pieces that belong back in tribal locations, but pieces that have been sort of taken out of context. And then the department is like, oh, we wouldn't use this now. We wouldn't exhibit this now. We don't need this now. Why keep all of this? And it's not just keeping it, it's maintaining it and conserving it and studying it. Because I think that in many ways, the museum itself advocates itself as a forward-thinking, future-looking, scientific driving machine that then also educates the public about science. But that's not what archives do, right? Like, archives are not future.
I'm going to propose something radical that I was just saying. Any museum, once it's established, the entire museum is an archive. Mm-hmm. Collecting material culture, collecting scientific research. The instant that research is done, it's an archive. The instant, you know, an anthropologist goes in to a culture and collects material culture and brings it back, all that material is part of just a vast archive. And I look at a library as an archive, a museum as an archive. I think any institution that collects anything or does research on anything, they essentially become an archive. And I think it's some, I mean, I look at some of the stuff we've collected and I'm like, oh, we have too many of those. We really should, you know, be more careful about what we save, just because we run out of room. And then we have to kind of investigate and research those items and saying, well, what's important? What do we think is going to be important to the future? And I think one of the biggest things is, or looking at what you're saying, is what people deem not important today may be important 100 years from now. Mm-hmm. And I think any collections, any museums have to think to the future. And they have a responsibility, a social responsibility to preserve these things. And, you know, we were talking about returning things. I must admit, I'm mixed about things like that. should the British Museum return the Parthenon friezes. One half of me says, well, they preserve them because they would have been destroyed when, you know, when it was bombed. But I also think, oh, then I think they should return them to the government. And I know that's going to be a political hot pot. But I'm also an immigrant in a country where sometimes the immigrants in the United States outnumber the country they came from. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that those people have an opportunity to see their culture without having to travel and spend the money to go back. And so the collections of the Met, the collections here, I do find important. I do think that human remains should be returned because I personally have no qualms about human remains. I don't, I think when someone passes away, it just becomes part of the earth. But other cultures don't view that way. And I think we need to, I don't want to say indulge, but I think we need to respect that. Yeah. But I also think that our collections that we made of cultures from around the world are very important to the people here in America. I mean, I think we have so many immigrants from, let's just pick a Ghana. And I think that the fact that they can come and look at their, you know, this is, you know, these are historical objects. It may not be what, you know, they use today, but they can come here and look at the objects that their ancestors used. I think it's important. As part of the project, as you know, I'm researching Charles Alston, mm-hmm. a Harlem artist from the 20s and 30s. And when I was reading about him, I was amazed that he had to come to this museum to research African sculpture mm-hmm. because no other museums in New York City, the Met hadn't started their quote primitive collection at that time, but this was the only place where he could go and look at what his culture produced in Africa. Mm-hmm. And I find that that's amazing. And that's important, I think, for immigrants to be able to do that.
Right.
So I know I'm not really answering your question about the importance of archives, but I think collecting for the future, because we don't know what's going to be important. We have memorabilia meetings once a week, and I've been invited to be part of that. And we look at all the things that are collected in memorabilia, and I think the questions I always ask, how do you think that will be used in the future? Do you see that being used in an exhibit? Do you see a researcher who would be interested in that? And then almost in every case, we find some importance in it. Just the fact that it was produced is important. Mm-hmm. But do we need 30 examples of it?
So this is so fascinating. And it relates back to an interview that I did with two biologists at mm-hmm. UConn and about their biodiversity collection. And it's very funny because I very much more as, again, somebody whose disciplinary area is in visual studies, my understanding of museums is always one of space crunch. And I know that this also sort of contradicts with what a lot of people would say is that also all museums have too much stuff. And, you know, the Met only shows like, you know, 5% of what
we
they
show
own.
1%.
So right, exactly. I mean, that sort of there's this question that hovers over art museums or just sort of museum institutions that often sort of emphasizes this idea of there's too much. It was interesting talking to these biologists because they were aghast at my suggestion that, like, why did you need so many samples, so many dry samples, so many wet samples? Like, that all of these, you know, we had this really sort of active conversation offline, actually, about, you know, at one point in one of my questions, I said something about, you know, this seems like a lot of dead animals to me. And they're like, that's actually really offensive to us. Like, that's really offensive. And right. That's actually really missing the entire point of how much diversity we need to make any kind of knowledge. And I was thinking about how interesting it is that in art and material cultures and collections, we're encouraged to think of diversity, but in a very sort of small way, and not in terms of like, we actually need all of these different kinds of examples because each of them highlights these sort of different aspects that at different moments have been, you know, privileged, or that you can't get a real, you know, I mean, again, and the scientists use this example, like you can't pick 30 humans and imagine that you have any sense of how, like, you can't make
That's
any
a perfect analogy, right?
Yeah, you can't make any biological, you know, assessments of anything, because right. that's not enough. It's not enough. It's not a scientifically valid argument to make. And so that their parameters of knowledge are in some ways, you know, what they were arguing. And again, I'm just sort of pooling all these really cool interviews, is this sort of idea that no, more is more knowledge. More is never less. More is always more. Because if you don't have enough, then all you're getting is random information.
In a small sample. I mean, yeah. I look at, you know, we have vast natural history collections here. And I'm
so many dead animals, if I can say.
But yes, or, you know, we have, I think, you know, I love the fruit fly analogy. We have 1 million fruit flies, and we probably have millions of ants and things like that.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even the speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA Playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA Playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
UConn is the ants.
You told me that about that. That's why you said that ant. But I look at how much DNA research has changed in the last 20 years, and I feel that it's important. I mean, we have a frozen tissue lab, but we also just have samples of everything. That 100 years from now, who knows what they will be able to determine from that ant that was collected in an anthill in Madagascar, what knowledge they will gain. You know, I know there are sampling collections to see how pollution has increased and how heavy metals have increased. And I think that's all going to be vastly important. And I think your analogy of, you know, collecting humans, not that I'm saying advocating.
No. Yeah, no,
he meant I mean, if you came in New York City and chose randomly 30 people on the street, they would be so vastly
different. Well, the first question would be, what street? Like, right. you know, like that even in a place that prides itself on incredible diversity, you can absolutely go to any location and find, you know.
As much as we may talk about the colonial collecting in the past, but I think in many times they came out, especially at this museum here, that they were collecting because these things were going to disappear. That's animals, that's cultures.
Although I will say, I mean, I just want to put this on record, is that you create that narrative and it justifies the narrative, right? I mean, that there becomes this way in which that narrative of collection becomes a manipulation of power. Right. Although, I mean, I mention this only to sort of suggest that I do find it really interesting that we don't actually apply the same idea of the need for diversity, a need for completion and a kind of wholeness when we think about our own collections, that we are so often thinking about paring it down, finding the best example. And of course, that's already perhaps folly in this sort of idea of like, well, what is best to the group of people sitting around at that moment is also about how much access you have, what else is out there, that kind of thing. So,
but I also would love to think of museums as being a vast lending library.
Yeah.
I mean, this museum is very good about lending scientific specimens to other scientists who are working, but I also think that art museums, you know, if we have 95% of our collection in storage, I wish there was the money and the inclination to do that. But, you know, we should be opening up or lending materials into a small village in Guatemala. And, you know, I'm not saying that we give them these things, but I think if we lend them and show them how to preserve them and then how to interpret them in their own words and language, you know, I think the future of truth without borders, I would love to see that. Just, you know, we could be able to do this. You brought up a point about, I think one of the interesting things about the evolution of the museum, I look at the Hall of Ocean Life. Mm-hmm. So the earliest incarnation of the hall was just, oh, look, we have all these specimens and they're stuffed and they show, I don't want to say the diversity, but they just show that, oh, look, this comes from the ocean. And then in the 20s, they changed that, and the Hall of Ocean Life and many other halls in the museum were, what can the natural world provide to man? So it looked at whaling, it looked at oil exploration, and the focus was that. It was just how, I mean, you look, we had a hall of building stones, we had a hall of wood. It was looking at how mankind can use these collections. And then in the 60s, that radically changed, and they went to ecology and preservation. What can we do to preserve these things? So instead of thinking, as they thought in the 20s, oh, we're going to lose these things, they really started focusing on how do we save and preserve them.
Right.
And I think that's with anything in life, things evolve. And one hopes they evolve, or they evolve to where you want them to be. But, you know, evolution is a finicky thing. Sometimes I look at politics today and I'm horrified how things have evolved in many areas.
Devolved.
I mean, but it is a change, and, you know, that some of those people are becoming the majority. So is that evolution? I have family members that I'm horrified that they're highly educated, and the things they believe in, it's just, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe you believe that. And you know, you got your PhD in oil, you know, technology. And I'm like, no, that just isn't a go. But that's another exhibit in another story.
Yeah. Let's get back to some fun stuff. So one of the things that Joel has been doing specifically for the Seeing Truth exhibition is working on the instigator items. And one of the things that happened over the process of sort of picking out some instigator items from the collection, and then the pandemic hit. So then there was this sort of major pause of all kinds of things and the library and accessibility and that. And then things got sort of moving again, and Joel came on board. And Joel has really transformed in a really positive way, sort of the stretch of the instigator items. And so much of the very cool research that has been done because of Joel and Joel's work, along with Katrina and our fabulous TAs, Joel, who you work with, who put it all on the web and make it so that it can be sort of moved around in different ways. You know a lot about the collection, you've known a lot about the collection, but I also know that there are things that you have discovered that have been like, what?
Right.
So tell us some of the fun stuff. What have you found while digging around looking for truth in your collection?
Right. I mean, that's part of the hardest part of my job, is that I'll start something and then I'll get waylaid because I'm fascinated with what I'm reading, and has nothing to do with what I'm researching, but I'm like, oh my God, I didn't know that. Or, oh, look at this. But I look at each, I mean, you one of the questions you had said you were going to ask me is what my favorite object is, and I must admit my favorite object is whatever I'm working on at the moment. I'm having so much fun. But I look at one of the first ones that I did on my own that hadn't been looked at by anybody else, and that was on Toshiaceda. Mm-hmm. And you know, they were pretty watercolors of fish, and I didn't know a lot about him other than he went on a boat and he painted pretty pictures of fish. And just researching that, okay, part of that is the whole idea that color photography, and the fact when you collect a fish and you put them in alcohol, they lose their color. So it was very important that you had an artist on any collecting trip. And then when I started looking at the man, I just became fascinated. This was a real Renaissance man. This is a man came over from Japan, wanted to get an education. His family lost their money because of the Tokyo earthquake. But he worked hard, and he found a place for himself working for this museum, working for the museum in San Francisco. He tried out everything. He became a taxidermist. He became a photographer. He was a really talented artist. And then World War II happened. And he and his family were sent off to a camp. And I'm like, oh my God, that's just, and this is a man who embraced America, embraced what it could do, and sent him to a camp in the middle of Nevada. And then when he got out of the, I mean, he still did his artwork when he was there. It was more social commentary on life in the camp. But when he came out, he was able to find his footing again in a scientific institution. And they embraced him, and he finally retired there, you know, I would say at the top of his field. And just reading and learning about him was just so fascinating for me. You know, what I thought was just pretty watercolors of fish just had such a rich tapestry. And then I think part of it was that he was the man who, on the expedition for the museum, went to Easter Island and made a cast of one of the moai. And then that cast, or he made a mold, I should say, of a moai. And then that mold came back to the museum, and later on they made a casting of it. And then the fact that in the, I don't know, 2000s, that became a star in a silly fun movie, Night at the Museum. And within weeks of that movie coming out, that object was in the back of a hall that was a hall that was known for you go there to make out, because no one went to it at that time. Sorry, Margaret Mead, but that was a very quiet hall.
Very dark and quiet. You have to walk to get there. Yeah.
And it became the destination.
Spaces, right? Like they are living spaces, like desires.
You would go in there and you would say, you know, teenagers hanging out because it was quiet and their teachers weren't bothering them. But then all of a sudden, 2 weeks after that movie came out, it became a destination just because of a character named Dum Dum. It just is amazing to me. And it all is because this man had made a cast of it in the 20s.
Right.
And brought it back. And just the connection there is just fascinating. And, you know, what is the truth? I mean, I think the British Museum carted one away. I'm sure the museum, if they could have, they would have carted one away, but they were too heavy for the boat they were on. Thank God. But just all the layers. And I know Katrina was like, oh, but you have to ask questions about it. And I'm like, well, just reading about it forms questions in your mind. And I was hard pressed to come up with questions for people about it. I'm just thinking, well, just reading all of this just forms so many questions in your mind. How did this man who had biting flies and had to carry his water for the plaster create a mold that then created an object that became an icon for millions of people?
Right.
And they come here, they line up, they get their selfies with the moai. And there are moais in many museums. I mean, you could buy one, you know, for your desk. And there's, like I said, they carted one off to England. And then they leave little packets of gum. And it's just it's the evolution and the transition of that object is just
amazing. I have to say, though, what I love about this conversation is that you have your sort of knowledge about the artist. Right. And so Katrina, just for our listeners, is a philosophy GA who's working on the exhibition and the website and has worked very closely with Joel. So she always brings this whole other set of philosophical.
Right, which has been great.
She's been sitting there working on her dissertation. And so she has all these different kinds of questions about objects. And of course, I'm sitting there and I'm listening to your story, Joel. And I'm like, this is an obvious story about how visual culture is the most important way in which we communicate ideas. And that Night of the Museum is just as important as any other part of this story in terms of everybody's move in terms of making knowledge and visual culture and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I think one of the things that's so great and has been a real treat on this project has been also the way we each come at these objects with our own set of questions and truths and the knowledge that we want to hear and sort of see sort of manifest it. But, and I will say this too, they are not just nice pictures of fish. They are stunning. And they will be at the exhibition at the Met. And then hopefully when the exhibition is at the AM&H, they'll be there too, because they really are gorgeous and so worth seeing. And they are examples of the kind of thing that gets tucked away. It's lost perhaps at scientific.
They were published in books, but you know, not everyone's going to take the time and effort to go get the book, turn to the page, and then so much of the color is lost in the printing process.
But I mean, you can really also feel, it is interesting because Joel sent me, and we can put a link to some of his works in internment camps, and you can see the same hand. I mean, it is right. Very different subject matter, but the hand of the artist remains. And it is also very interesting to see the sort of connection between the two. All right,
and
Joel.
After doing that, I was oh no, we have to get one of his paintings if we can. But unfortunately, they're mostly in Japan, so it's very difficult to get
there. Well, part of the thing that I think is lost a bit is how many really amazing artists took those talents and focused them on natural history and in the museum. And it would be amazing if more of those artists, their stories, their lives sort of came to the fore, because I do think also, like Charles Alston, that it also was a location that often gave voice and place to a lot of people that often in other locations in the art community were silenced and not provided support. So I also think that there's this very interesting way in which female identified artists, Black artists, Asian artists are represented in ways in the museum and in your collection, often in ways that are not similar to the way that they're represented at an art museum, for example. Right. But they are works of art, and they are in the broad sense of they are important monuments of visual culture. All right, I am going to put you on the spot now, Joel. I saw you already trying to wiggle out of it. We ask everyone at the end to talk about the instigator item that provokes you the most. So maybe not the one you like the most, but the object that maybe provokes you the most, that fills you with questions, and not just because you haven't researched it yet. That's not fair.
I'm going to say it's, and I must admit I'm researching it this week, but I don't know how to even describe it. It's the gorilla drawings, the anatomical gorilla drawings. Mm-hmm. One part of me is horrified that they had to go and collect these animals and kill them and dissect them. And then they made these amazing drawings of doing that. And half of me is like horrified by it. And the other half is just in awe of the time and energy they spent in documenting these magnificent animals. And I don't know where I am at on that. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I think it was, I'm trying to think who did the initial essay on the ravens. They didn't bring that part up, that the fact that we had to go and collect that. I definitely want to bring that out somehow. Even the people who collected them, Dr. Raven, was saying that it's just, he was very sad that he had to collect these magnificent animals, but he went and shot and killed them. So I don't know. It's a hard, tough one. The drawings are just stunning. Being partly an art historian, it's like, these should be in MoMA. These should be at the Met. They're just amazing. I mean, just the technical skill, but just looking at what they say, and I just don't know. So I'm working on that. And I think that probably those have given me the most things to think about and be emotional about.
It's funny. I think those drawings are, well, I think they're Rorschach tests, right? That everybody walks up to them and has a reaction. And that reaction is probably one that tells other people very much about who they are and that sort of thing. I will say that I knew I wanted to do an exhibition because Tom Bayonne, who is the director of the archive, Tom showed me those drawings and I gasped. I mean, they are visually overwhelming. And, you know, I didn't even see, I saw a full body image. And then because of subsequent research, actually the ones that will be at the Benton are arms and then a skull head piece. But just as sort of the contrast of the detail with then the sort of the micro and the macro, right? Is just, there's very few visual objects that are trying to work us both at the same time with such precision. And it is truly credit to the illustrators, because it's not an easy thing to do.
It's been fun researching them, because I discovered that one of the researchers liked to work late at night because the subway trains disturbed her hand while she was drawing. So she would work from like 2 to 6 when there was, the museum does shake a little bit with the subway.
It does, yeah.
And then another one actually requested permission to work from her home studio, which brought so many more questions because they weren't answered in that letter. But it was like, did she take the specimens home to work on them, or did she take, you know, an image or drawings? But right. The fact, you know, that this is someone, especially in this the day and age of COVID, that people were working from home. Well, this is someone in the 1940s that requested to work from home because it was easier for her to do, right. And got permission to do it.
Right.
And then, you know, both of them then went on to such diverse projects, went to India and illustrated Indian folktales, such a total difference than her anatomical drawings. Right. And the other one became, I would say, a working fine artist in the South, and she did very abstract work and made her living off of that. So it's just, you know, these are when they're in their youth doing this. But
interesting. Again, it's been so worthwhile to sort of also think about the deep dive of who's making these images, then how are those images moving around? How are these pieces of these artists that are all sort of moving through New York and having their own, that this is part of their own artistic or personal journey, and that intersects with the history of how we understand bodies and the universe and all that sort of thing. All right, Joel, last question. And it is, again, a question I have asked all of the people who are interviewing. And everybody also, this is the traditional thing, is that people balk at one. They want, like, can I just give you five truths? Or can I, you know, so they try to get around the question. But the question is, I need you to tell me one thing that you know is a truth, and then tell me how you know that it is the truth. What evidence do you have? And again, why is this your truth? Something you know?
Yeah, I looked at that question and I honestly did not know how to answer that, because as I've seen by looking at all these things, there is no truth with anything, because it's always open to interpretation. What I may see as truth this year, next year, I may see it as something different. So I am going to evade it and not tell you an absolute truth. I'm so sorry.
You know what? Maybe that's your absolute truth.
Truth, I guess, is I love looking at collections and artwork. I don't know. To me, that's a personal truth.
Okay. But that's a truth. Why is a personal truth not a truth?
That's true. that's also true. But what is amazing to me is that the research that I'm doing today, someone 10 years from now could reinterpret it all, which is great. I mean, that's what we were looking at. When I was thinking about truth and what is truth, and I was thinking, well, is a fiction book truth? Because it's a work of imagination. And I was thinking, well, it is, because it's a product of that person's culture and life, and that is their truth. Mm-hmm. And the imagination is a truth. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Those are my few words.
Your musings on truth. I like it. I think it's very cohesive, actually. Right. I think it's a good note to end on.
You've been listening to a special Seeing Truth episode of the Why We Argue podcast, Future of Truth Edition. Many thanks to Toby Napolitano at the University of California, Merced, who handles our sound. And thanks to our sponsors, the University of Connecticut Humanities Institute, the Henry Luce Foundation, and Vanderbilt University. The Why We Argue podcast is a proud member of the New Books Network.